Welcome back to the second episode of Why Codes Real Talk. I'm Atharva Anand, a sophomore at Westwood High School.
And I'm your co-host, Akshara Anand, an eighth grader at Grisha Middle School. Why Codes Real Talk is a podcast with a series of interviews with physicians. Our mission is to make medicine and healthcare more relatable for teens and young adults by diving into real-world problems, debunking myths, and sharing inspiring stories with medical professionals. Through fun and engaging conversations, we aim to spread awareness and inspire the next generation to explore healthcare and make more informed decisions.
Today, we're thrilled to have a very special guest, Dr. Palak Goswami. How are you doing on this fine morning?
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me. It's a chilly day here in Philly, but hopefully it gets warmer, I think it may.
Hopefully here too. It's the cold front is blowing. It's pretty cold now.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today. Dr. Goswami pursued a BS and PhD in mathematics, focusing on probability theory and stochastic calculus at Carnegie Mellon University and UT Austin. Following his advanced mathematical studies, he transitioned to medicine and attended medical school at Vanderbilt University. Now he is an interventional radiology resident at the University of Pennsylvania. In addition, he's a strong research focus in oncology, driven by a deep connection to the patient population. We are so happy to have you as a guest today.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me to be the second guest. That's awesome.
Great. Now, on this episode of Why Codes Real Talk, we are going to go over what interventional radiology is and how it is beneficial, including how it works, improves outcomes, and enhances quality of life for patients. Now, Dr. Goswami, can you please inform us about what radiology is?
Yeah, you know, let me take you back 50 to 60 years into the doctor's office. Walk in, you have a complaint. My throat is sore. My arm hurts. Doctor takes a good look at you, asks you a bunch of questions. When did it start hurting? How long has your throat been sore? At that time, they still have some blood labs. They may take some blood and run some tests. But for the most part, talking to you and feeling for physical exam changes were the two things that drove a lot of medical decision making around half a century ago or so. That all dramatically changed with imaging. First, it was x-rays, where they used high-energy photons to take images through your skin to look inside your body to see with your own two eyes what's going on. And over the past 20 to 30 years, this technology has really exploded. We have CT, MRI, ultrasound, nuclear medicine. I mean, there's a whole host of technological advancements happening as we speak that allow us to take a better look at what's going on inside the body. And by look, I mean literally pictures, both anatomy, physiology, what is changing, what's not changing. And the radiology really is the part of medicine physicians that specialize in understanding what these images are, how they're made, what they're useful for, and what you can use from these images to make decisions about patients. Fractures are very simple, but there's also very complicated fractures as well. So that's what radiology is.
That's amazing. Radiologists are just like the detectives of medicine, interpreting x-rays, CT scans, MRIs, and much more. But what about the subspecialty, interventional radiology? How does it differ from traditional radiology, and what makes it so unique?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, it wouldn't really make a difference between traditional radiology and IR in the sense that for me, my approach to interventional radiology is very much based on this principle that all of the decisions, a large number of the decisions being made today about patient care are based on imaging. So if you're going to have a surgery, if you're going to have an intervention, a lot of surgeons, they want to look at the images themselves. They want to see what they're going to do before they do it. And interventional radiology really just, you know, it's the radiologists who find that, hey, this is something that we can do as well, or we can do is tend to stay out of the OR, tend to stay out of big, big cases. I mean like a long, long time. It's not necessarily true. You can do all sorts of things with image guidance and interventional radiology specializes in.
So during an IR procedure, is a patient awake or under anesthesia? And also, what other specialties would be present in the room during one of these procedures?
So yeah, I mean, there's procedural or surgical specialty when it comes to making a decision about anesthesia. So anesthesia really is broken down into two components. One is the numbing and sort of the amnesic effect that nobody remembers being under anesthesia. And the other part is a paralytic effect. People who are under anesthesia are paralyzed. So, you know, for the majority of procedures in interventional radiology, you know, patient can be awake. They can be, no other doctor in the room is necessary. The interventional radiologist can administer the medicine that makes the patient feel calm. It takes away some of the pain. But usually those are well-controlled opioids, and the entire procedure is done that way. But there are other procedures. Sometimes we need for the pain, but most of the time to keep the patient paralyzed, we have to put them completely to sleep. Think about cryoablation surgeries where, you know, if you move a little bit, then the images change and we can't really have that. So I think those are the two major things. But for the most part, intervention radiology, patient's awake and we're talking to them, and we're sometimes even the patient wants to see the images as we're taking them.
So starting with how IR enhances a patient's quality of life, what are some like common procedures in IR that would, you know, like directly improve someone's day-to-day life?
Yeah. So, you know, interventional radiology. So in my mind, I split into two major buckets of things. So first role that interventional radiologists can play is a support role and support to other physicians who are doing their primary management. For example, somebody who's had a recent surgery or somebody who's going to be receiving chemotherapy or somebody who has an infection that is sort of like collected into a little pocket of pus. You know, pop your pimples, those are pretty gross, but sometimes those pimples are inside your body and they're much more gross, trust me. But the other big category of procedures that interventional radiology does is sort of the primary management of a pathology. And so I think both of those things are extremely valuable. So interventional radiologists, when they're available, if they're available, they can be your ticket out of major problems. They can be your ticket out of having to have big surgery to solve a relatively small problem. I guess it's a big problem if you need a big surgery, but a problem they can solve with a needle. That is actually the biggest thing that intervention radiology does. But there's also other things for management of pain and management of cancers. So I think that the support role is where you see a lot of intervention radiology, but there's also primary things that intervention radiologists do.
But does IR minimize recovery time compared to surgeries? And if so, how does it do that?
Great question. So it does it in two ways. So, you know, imagine you got a big surgery. Think about a smaller surgery. Let's start with a smaller surgery, appendicitis. Yeah. I'm sure you all have heard of appendicitis. Yeah, it's a vestigial organ, or at least we believe it's a vestigial organ. I recently read a paper that argued that the appendix is vestigial and other animals, it's helpful in digesting plants. I'm not sure how true that is, but in us, it's mostly useful for developing infections and cancer. Appendicitis happens very commonly. Very difficult to know if the appendix is already ruptured when you are before the surgery. And really, the surgery is the primary modality to treat it. Just cut it out. But you go inside, the surgeons go inside, the appendix is perforated. And once it's perforated, it can have big balls of fluid collection. After the surgery is done, hopefully everything goes well. But once the bacteria escapes outside of the bowel, it oftentimes finds a home inside your belly. That home needs to be sucked out so your body can essentially win the battle against the infection. So intervention radiologists offer a minimally invasive way to deal with this abscess. You can just put a needle right into the infection, put a drain in it, suck it all out, and the patient feels better immediately. So your month-long, 2-month-long, 3-month-long recovery with a surgery needed potentially is reduced to a, I don't know, 5-minute needle stick, and you go home the next day. I think that's like the biggest utility IR has for surgeons. And alternatively, because we're only using a needle stick, if I can do something that a surgeon would have to open you to do, you don't have to be open, so you can go home.
Yeah.
So there are those two major ways.
Yeah. So like I know recently my dad had appendicitis last year, yeah. And he got his surgery done, but instead of like opening it up, I'm sure he had like an interventional radiology kind of way. So they just like pulled it out from one side.
Yeah.
And that definitely reduced his management time after and his like his symptom relief and pain after. And he definitely he got better a lot quicker than if he were to get, I'm sure, like an open surgery. But yeah.
Most of the surgeons these days, they don't. So what you're talking about is a surgical intervention. It's also minimally invasive. They use ports. So they don't have to go open. But even if you use ports, you can still get the appendix can still be ruptured and you can get fluid collections afterwards. And at that point, using ports would be a bad idea.
So how does the precision of IR reduce complications and improve overall outcomes for patients as compared to a traditional surgery?
It's really a matter of scale. So I think the collection of things that interventional radiologists have specialized in, it relies heavily on image guidance. which is why the radiology part of it is very important. So you have to understand the images to understand what you're going to do during the procedure. But because you're using only small incisions and only small instruments to perform the goal, the recovery after that is not that dramatic. The insult to the body with general anesthesia, you don't need it for a lot of these things. The insult to the body with a big scar, you don't necessarily need it. You don't necessarily need as much anesthetic when you're doing an intervention radiology intervention, even if you need anesthesia overall. But I think the general philosophy is that if you can use image guidance, you can use smaller and specialized tools to do a smaller insult to the body while achieving similar or the same goal.
Great. So we know that IR could minimize time after surgery, but is it faster to do IR than open surgery?
Most of the time, there is very little overlap in the sense that there are indications for doing open surgery, like appendicitis, which you almost always need surgery because the goal is to remove something out of the body. But there are a lot of other times where you need to have just something sucked out, like something that's fluid, in which case you'll always do an interventional radiology procedure. So there are more and more areas where IR procedures are competing with surgery, but you know, it's really a team-based kind of an approach. And those are mostly in oncology. You can imagine a patient has a tumor and the patient's very, very sick. That's why they have the tumor. And you can't remove the tumor. Patient's so sick, they can't go to surgery. Mm-hmm. So the intervention radiologist can go in and destroy the tumor using some fancy toys. More than happy to talk about all the fancy toys, because I know that's the kind of stuff that's exciting about IR is the technology. There's so many toys.
Go ahead. I want to know about these fancy toys.
Yeah. So I'll tell you about this, you know, since we're talking about cancer already. You know, my grandfather unfortunately passed from lung cancer.
Sorry to hear.
And it was a long time ago. At that time, and it was in India. Every time I see a lung cancer case, I think about it. And these days, you know, for people who are as old as he, and the location of the tumor was on the outside of his lung.
Oh my gosh!
You can insert a needle, a very special needle, into the tumor from just through the skin. The patient's asleep for this procedure. They're under general anesthesia. They're paralyzed. The machine is breathing for them. You don't have to use that much anesthetic. The goal is just to keep the patient paralyzed. At this point, you can insert a needle into the tumor, and
yeah,
this needle has a very, very special structure. It has a core on the inside. It's empty on the inside, and you pass compressed neon, or I think it's the xenon, one of the noble gases through the needle core. And as a noble gas, as it expands, this is an endothermic process. So that process extremely cools the needle. And around the needle, you generate an ice ball. You make a popsicle out of the tumor. And it is an extremely effective way of destroying cells. Actually, so it's the cooling process itself doesn't destroy the cells. You cool, the shock freeze the cells, and then you warm them up, and then you cool them again, and then you warm them up. And that process of cooling and rewarming, it essentially destroys the structure of the cell, killing the tumor. And it has nothing to do with, you know, all the things that tumors do to evade your immune system, to survive despite your body trying to kill it. It just destroys everything. It's as close to surgery as you can get, you know, just because it's just absolutely destroying everything. Not even fat cells can survive, so to speak.
Would you use that more for benign tumors than malignant? Like if it spreads, would you still use that needle?
So most of this, so that's a great question. So if you have a suspicion that the tumor has already spread, then this procedure would not offer a cure. But before you do any intervention, you're suspicious for a cancer, you're thinking about a cancer, before you do any intervention, there's always a planning phase. You do a lot of imaging, which radiologists do, and a lot of interpretation of the imaging, again, what radiologists do. Sometimes they take a tissue sample, they have to biopsy the tumor. Again, radiologists do that. And then the team of radiologists, oncologists, surgeons, and sometimes radiation oncologists, they come together, and pathologists, they come together and they make a plan. At the end of that, you have a bunch of options, but you see, radiology already plays a lot a major role in this process. You know, the initial diagnosis is made by a radiologist. The tumor board needs a radiologist to interpret the fancy imaging required and to plan the treatment and to even biopsy to figure out what the hell is going on. And then you can even treat it. So you get the whole gambit.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that like some tumors can be just taken out by a needle. That's crazy to think. Go ahead. What were you saying out there, Val?
So I always had a question. In radiology, I've seen that you use a lot of scans, but I was wondering, why is it always black and white? Wouldn't color help, or is it just because it's cost effective?
That's a good question. You know, something to mull over. But the short answer is it's not necessary, because I'm sure by color, what you really mean is contrast. By color, you really mean I want to be able to tell that A is different than B. I'm looking at a tumor. I'm looking at something inside the body. I want to be able to tell tumor different from something else that's next to it that is not tumor. I want to be able to tell liver from pancreas. I want to be able to tell these things apart. That's really how color functions in our day-to-day life. And in radiology, we can do that. It's not color, it's through other means of giving contrast to images. So they still look black and white. That's kind of it's not aesthetically pleasing. But MRI can provide all different types of contrast. It can tell the difference between all different kinds of cells, all different kinds of tissues. It's honestly mind-boggling that we can do that.
Yeah. Can you walk us through a day, share with us a case where a patient, in your medical opinion, should have an IR procedure over an open surgery?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm going to be controversial, because this is a podcast and this is an opportunity to be controversial. Liver cancer is, I think, one of the things that I worked on when I was in medical school, and something that I'm interested in. Liver cancer is... It often occurs in patients who are already very sick. So there's a disease called cirrhosis that can happen to your liver. It has many functions in the body, too many to replace. Honestly, you can't go on, can't replace the function of the liver from something outside the body. And when you get a disease of the liver tries to regenerate itself. But once it's diseased, you can have a very high risk of cancer. Yeah. So I'm painting a picture of a patient who is already sick and then develops cancer and then is offered a surgery into an organ that is very difficult to replace. It is a very tenuous position to be in. And while there are a lot of tumors that you can take out very easily, there are many tumors that become very difficult to take out. And in those situations, in my opinion, personal opinion, the use of intervention radiology techniques for ablation, to essentially do what I described, sometimes with a needle, sometimes with some other fancier tools, to destroy the tumor from the inside without having to go through surgery, and then just following up with the patient with more imaging is better for the patient, is better for the health ecosystem, because the patient doesn't have to be in the hospital for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think overall that's better. It's a better intervention. Unfortunately, it takes time for people to adapt or to sort of accept these things. But I personally think that things like liver cancer, they should be treated more and more with intervention radiology.
Yeah. If the patient doesn't want it, how would you help the patient make the call? Is there anything you can do? Or
far be it for me to try to convince a patient to do something. And more often than not, patients want surgery less than they want a poke in the groin to get into the tumor. But I think, for me, the biggest drawback of these kinds of procedures is that you don't get to physically see the tumor exit your body. That's a very reasonable apprehension for patients to have, that I want the tumor to be taken out of my body and I want it to be in a bucket where somebody sees it, takes a picture and sends it to me.
Would you be able to like physically take it out in a surgery?
Yeah.
Like, will you be able to like see it?
Yeah, they literally see it. You open up liver, you go inside, you physically see the liver and you cut it. I mean, it's very satisfying. I've been in many of those surgeries as a medical student, as an intern. And I think that there's definitely advantages seeing the tumor get out of your body. But for a lot of patients, you know, if you're 60, 70 years old, you have a lot of other reasons to not go into surgery, destroying the tumor and watching it carefully are very good options.
Yeah, okay.
Doesn't matter if you get surgery or if you get an intervention radiology procedure, we're going to follow you with imaging no matter what. Because even after surgery, you can take out the tumor, put it in a bucket, but there may be still a tumor left behind that you can't see or tumor elsewhere that you can't treat. So I think that there's like, I would say that for a lot of people, it's about the cost and the benefit. The cost of surgery is very high for a lot of people. It's very difficult to recover from a major surgery like liver surgery, and that you cannot do easily. We would never make the call on our own. In an ideal setting, it would be a decision between the intervention radiologists, the surgeons, and the patient together. And just because, you know, I'm not a surgeon, so it won't be possible for me to talk about the risks and benefits effectively. And the surgeon on intervention radiologist, that they can't do that either. So we really want to do what's best for the patient. And oftentimes, big open surgery is not the answer.
Can you, this is like a whole different gear, but can you just walk us through like a day in your life as an IR resident?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now I'm in the diagnostic radiology portion of my training. So if you're going to do an intervention radiology residency, you are going to do medical school. You're going to do 1 year of intern year. I was in Austin, Texas. That was pretty rough. And then you will do 3 to 4 years of diagnostic radiology and 1 to 2 years of intervention radiology. So for a diagnostic radiology resident, most of the time you wake up and you go to the hospital sometime between 6 and 7, depending on, 6:30 and 7:30, depending on what your program wants you to do when they have lectures. And then you basically work when the bosses work. You will work from 8 to 5-ish. And at that time, you will look at the images, make your interpretations, and then your bosses, the physicians who are fully licensed, will look over your interpretations. You will discuss them, and then you will essentially support the teams that are making decisions for the patients on the floor or outside the hospital. You'll have call. So for us, it would be after work, after 5 o'clock, you stay in the hospital until 9 or 10, and then you go home. And next year, as you get more and more experience, you get more and more call, more and more independent calls. You'll be overnight. You go to the hospital at 10 a.m., at 9 p.m. You stay there until 9 a.m. You do that for some time. Then you will do that as a diagnostic radiology resident as well. When you go to the intervention radiology training, it's a little bit more like classical medicine, where you go to the hospital around 6, 7 in the morning. You read up on the patients that you have for the day. You field any questions and consults that the teams in the hospital may have throughout the day. You do your procedures and you leave whenever they're done. And there's an emergency or something needs to be done right now, there's always a person on call, which sometimes will be you. You'll have to go to the hospital if necessary to deal with the problem or deal with it from home. And of course, sometimes there's emergency cases. The patient's bleeding on the floor and they need your help right now, then you got to go. Somebody is having a major crisis with their kidneys. They need you to go right now. You got to go.
I've heard that there's like a hierarchy within like the hospital and that residents are at the bottom. Is that true or is that just like a myth?
Well, it's not true, but there's not a myth that there is a hierarchy in the hospital. The hierarchy in the hospital at the bottom is definitely pre-med students. So if you're going to be volunteering at a hospital, bottom of the barrel, get bullied by everybody. And then above them are the medical students who get to bully maybe a little bit of the pre-med students. Above the medical students are the interns, the first year residents who were medical students not too long ago, trying to get their feet wet, bullied by everybody. And then above them are the doormats and the doors. And then above the doormats, they're the residents. The residents are actually pretty high up on this hierarchy. They're oftentimes independent and they oftentimes make all the calls. Oftentimes they're the doctor treating you. So if you go to the hospital anywhere in America, chances are the resident is taking care of you. And then they're doctors and they get supervision. But in other countries, the residents will be treating you without supervision. So that is the hierarchy.
Okay. So I believe you said you did some research for cancer, if I'm correct. So can you please share some of your findings with us, if possible?
Yeah. Absolutely. Like I said, some of the prior work that I did was regarding tumors in the liver. And the study was very simple. We took data from patients who have advanced liver disease and I questioned whether treating those liver tumors with ablation using internal radiation, that's sort of another technology. But instead of using a needle to generate a frost ball to make a cancer popsicle, we essentially use radiation to liquefy the cancer from the inside. And we basically were able to show that there is a good reason if the patient is overall healthy, the patient has a good day-to-day life, then even if they have metastatic disease, it's reasonable to offer them this cancer liquefaction intervention. And the idea is very simple. If you're doing well otherwise, then it's better to kill the tumor because the tumor is probably going to cause liver failure, and the liver failure is going to kill you. So better to people who already have, who have good liver reserve, if they have good liver reserve, then it's better to liquefy the cancer than to allow the cancer to overtake the liver function. So it's a very simple principle, and we were able to find some evidence to show that.
Now, I also have a question. So like doctors preached all day long that sleep is important, but I've seen in many medical dramas, such as Grey's Anatomy or House MD, that residents do not get close to enough sleep. What are your thoughts on this?
Again, controversial opinion. I think that it's a tragedy that residents don't get sleep. And I think it would be honestly horrifying if people knew how little sleep the doctors that are treating them actually get. It's bad for patients. It's bad for the physicians. It's bad for the health ecosystem. Unfortunately, it costs money. It costs money to let residents sleep. And I think that is the bottom line. As a healthcare system, we have to find ways to generate time and resources and essentially to finance the ability for residents to sleep. It's a tragedy. There are a lot of things that are happening in the positive direction. The ACGME, the College of Graduate Medical Education, has made hours that restrict duty so that residents do get sleep. So you can't work more than 80 hours a week, LOL. Universities and academic centers are also, they're also picking up on that. So things are headed in the right direction, but I think we have a long way
to go. It takes some time. We have some like more personal, more advice questions for you.
Yeah.
First of all, just like, why did you want to become a doctor? And it's not just because you like science and helping people, right?
Yes, I think it's a tragedy that the competitiveness of medical education has forced people to do something weird, something different. And you know, literally everybody you ask in the hospital right now, those are the two reasons why they became physicians, is because they love to help people on a one-to-one basis, directly helping people, and they love the fact that they could understand why they were helping them. Unfortunately, these days, medical schools can be picky. You know, it's often important to have a mission. You know, for me, the mission, I've already had a PhD in mathematics. Money was not going to be a problem. The job was not going to be a problem. For me, the idea of using innovation, of changing the way we do healthcare, we deliver healthcare, mm-hmm. something that was very special to me. Just because we are in a critical portion in the development of technology in our society where everything is changing so rapidly. If physicians aren't literate about technology, if they aren't passionate about technology, then there's going to be no other person to advocate for the patients in rooms where these decisions are going to be made. Because companies don't necessarily care about the patients, and the patients themselves are not in the room. You know, companies are, they have positive missions, but at the end of the day, they're driven by profit. And I think physicians play an important role in being the advocates for patients and their guardians in rooms where they'll never be invited to. So that for me, that is why it was important. That is why I wanted to become a doctor. And I think that everybody has to find their mission. It's unfortunate that these days in medical education, you have to find this mission sometimes before you even get into medical school.
Great.
So I also wanted to ask you, why did you pick IR specifically as your subspecialty?
Yeah, that's a great question. Picking a specialty is a very personal choice, very personal decision. So far be it for me to tell you what you should pick, but I came into medicine because I'm passionate about technology. I'm passionate about, you know, how medicine changes, and the pulse of that, it's in radiology much more so than it is in any other part of the hospital. Mm-hmm. The specialty as a whole, it's driven by new imaging modalities, new techniques. That is the value that radiology has to clinical practice, is finding new ways to see what and why things are going wrong in the body. I always came into medicine with this thought on doing radiology, and sort of very naturally fit into the culture. And the first time I saw an intervention radiology procedure, it was sort of captivating. So it was almost an embarrassing story. It wasn't one of these big cancer cases that got me captivated. It was a very simple case of a patient who had a liver transplant. Liver transplants are very complicated cases. You know, actually the surgery portion, even the surgeons will tell you, is not the hardest part. The hardest part is because people who need liver transplants are very sick. And so managing them after the surgery is very complex, and you may have to do a lot of things to allow the patients to heal from the surgery. And so one of the patients that I was part of the team for taking care of them as a med student, after the surgery, they developed a fluid collection that became infected. And a person mm-hmm. was sick at baseline, got a liver transplant, acutely became sicker from the liver transplant, then got an infection. This person is teetering on death, essentially. Now, there are a lot of ways to treat this. We tried to treat it with antibiotics. It didn't work. And now you're left with two options. Either you put a needle in and a catheter to suck out the fluid and allow the body to win, or you go back in with a big surgery and wash it out. Well, those are basically your two options. And the intervention radiology team was trying to find many different ways to do this, but the fluid was in such an awkward position that it just didn't seem possible to get the needle into this fluid collection safely. And so we were going back and forth all day long, and until one of the intervention radiologists, William Winters, he was a chief resident earlier on in my medical education, he became an attending. He brought the patient down, gave them a little bit of fentanyl, an opioid, and benzodiazepine. Patient was fully awake, and he used a needle and he ultrasound and guided the needle through a safe channel in the body and put the needle into the fluid collection, put the wire in, put the catheter in, sucked it out. You know, it was an all day back and forth, surgery, no surgery, surgery, no surgery, surgery, no surgery. And then, you know, between cases, IR attending, he had a case right before it and then right after it. In 7 minutes, he solved the entire problem. Oh, I actually got to see this patient walk out of the hospital 5 days later on his own two legs. It was wild. I mean, that got me, you know, liver surgery, very exciting. Liver anesthesia, extremely exciting.
Yeah.
ICU, very exciting. But the idea that you can use the tools that already exist at your disposal in this weird, cool way using imaging, it was the most high stakes video games I had ever seen. So that got me in. I was all in at that point.
So I have a quick question. I know a lot of people say that they go into med school, they go into residency thinking they're going to specialize in something and they do something else. Did you initially go in thinking that you do interventional radiology?
No, not at all. I was pretty convinced that I would not be doing anything surgical or procedural. I had my PhD in mathematics. I was a very cerebral kind of a guy.
Yeah.
But now I can't even imagine living life without doing intervention. Getting into medical school, it's very important to have a mission or a passion or something that you want to do. But when you get to medical school, you have to be open to being influenced and changing that perspective, because things are going to change. I mean, you know, like, especially with these new combination programs, where you have like 4 years of undergrad and 4 years of med school and you get in straight away. Or even sometimes it's like 2 years of undergrad, but like, especially in programs like that, where, you know, you don't necessarily know, like you have 8 years, 4 years of undergrad, 4 years of medical school, and then 5 to 7 years of residency. I mean, that's like a long time. That's like 13 plus years, 13 years ago. I mean, you don't even have memories 13 years old, you know, as a person applying into college. So, you know, there's like a lot of things that can change. So it's kind of a double-edged thing. You should have a passion. It's great for medical school applications, but also it helps you understand the kind of person that you want to be as a doctor. But when you're in medical school, you should always be open to getting influenced by other doctors, other medical students, other patients. And your passion will change as you change, and that's fine.
So we all know that life as a resident is so tough. So what are some things you did to stay grounded?
Yeah, life as a resident is tough. Yeah, it's tough in some ways. It's mostly tough because of the time, because You make high stakes decisions. You do a lot of things that, you know, can insult you as a person, as a human being. So for me, it's really been about trying to be a human being outside of the hospital as much as I can. I'm an avid gamer. And so I do that. I play games. One of my best friends is an awesome. So him and I, we hop on, you know, Space Marines 2, and we play it a little bit. That's the flavor of the month. I go to the gym and I lift regularly. It's good for my health, of course, but I think it also, it's very cathartic. It, you know, it makes you feel like a person again and normalizes your humor, so to speak. And then you can go right back at it and understand that, you know, you're going to get punched at the hospital. You're going to have a difficult time. It's just going to happen. That can't be changed. The only thing that can be changed is how you deal with it.
Life as a resident, is it portrayed, like, in all honesty, is it like similar to what you see in like medical dramas, or is it like completely different?
It's very different. I think that the medical, like, I think Scrubs does a really good job of capturing some of the poignancy of medicine, trying to understand some of those like personal, very personal stories. But I think that I haven't watched all of them, but I think that the true harshness of doing it for years, the harshness of being sleep deprived and making decisions that will, you know, impact somebody that could look just like you, could look just like your mom. You know, that's a very, very, very grating. And I don't think there's any way to know it until you're there.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, if I were to tell people the things that, that happen in residency, I mean, it's honestly appalling, but you know, that's, you just have to accept the fact that things are going to be different. And I don't think the TV shows would be popular if they showed reality.
Just like a random question, but can you recommend a book that you enjoy personally, like your favorite book?
Sci-fi or
just
or,
anything, like your all-time favorite book.
All-time favorite book. So many choices. I do have to say it's going to have to be Lord of the Rings book one.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite books. The universe building in that book, top notch.
Yeah. And do you have any medical books you would recommend?
For medical books, there's a book, House of God. I don't know. It's a brutal book. I wouldn't recommend it until you're like well into medical school. There is a book called, I'm not a big fan of Atul Gawande just because the way he writes, just a technical thing.
Yeah.
There is a similar spirit book, on the, it's called Shock. It's by a woman who was a, she was a medicine doctor, I think. I'm forgetting which kind of doctor she was. I think she was a medicine doctor, but she had a very, very rare complication during her pregnancy. And it was just very, very long and difficult for her to deal with that. And I think that book, that again, the technically, it may not be the best written book because she's a doctor. She's not like a Pulitzer Prize winning writer. She's a doctor. Yeah. But I think that that story really captures a lot of sort of complexity about what's going on these days in medicine, about trying to, like, you know, how do you deal with something that's so human as life and death, and so she had a problem in pregnancy. So she had, there's a lot of expectation attached to that pregnancy about, I'm going to have a family. I'm going to have, and then she has a devastating complication. And so your life can swing so wildly as a patient. How do you reconcile such dramatic changes in a person's life with the industry of medicine, with the need that you have to make money, that you have to treat all these patients, that you have to train doctors? It's just like a staggeringly, in my opinion, a staggeringly human story about the picture of healthcare.
That's amazing. So last question of today, do you have any tips or advice for anyone looking to join the medical field?
Yeah, so medical field is huge. So I think anywhere from nursing to PAs to NPs to physicians, there's an entire spectrum of medical field. I can't really speak too much about the former. As a physician, the biggest tip that I can have is you have to find, again, like I said, I don't think this is fair to ask a person to know this before going into medical school, but I think it is most important to find a vision of who you are and who you are going to be as a doctor, who you want to be as a doctor. And it can be, you know, I want to be a person who is the go all person for a community. Like, I want to be a doctor in a rural part of Texas that if there's any problem, whether it's OB related, pregnancy related, whether it's gallbladder, appendicitis, any problem that you have, you can come to me and I will help you. And that is who I want to be. And I want to serve that patient population. That is a very legitimate and respectable mission. Or it could be something different. It could be something like, I have a technical background. I'm interested in technology. I'm driven by all these cool things that are happening in technology right now. And I do not want patients to fall behind the curve. And that's my mission in medicine. That is legitimate as well. So you can pick whatever you want to find your mission. But I think to do that, you have to explore. You have to talk to people.
Yeah.
Podcast maybe. and so explore a lot and try to find your mission and, okay, you know, do the best you can with that. And everything else, grades and all that stuff, that'll fall into place. You have to work hard. But once you have your mission, you'll have the internal motivation to do that, I'm sure.
We've had a really insightful conversation today, and we really do appreciate you being here, Dr. Goswami.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This has been so much fun, and I'm so glad that I can be a part of this.
This has been episode 2, Medicine's Hidden Hero of White Coats Real Talk. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye.